contact there, and maybe that's exactly what Vito is running into. So, in the next few days, we'll be hearing from him as he disassembles that trap. For a Kraepelin guy like you, I'm pretty sure you'd be able to fix that trap yourself, Charlie, unless it really burned up in smoke. To me, K2HMM, K2RIW.
Well, we had a couple of issues. Well, that time the antenna wasn't as high as it was. Pain to lower it down. But I disassembled it. Some marking things. I wire brushed it all out, cleaned it up, and all that stuff. Went back to normal. Time when I had problems, I was a little upset. Apparently, the bugs had got over it too. Sorry. Misplaced the trap. Great, great for a few minutes, but I'd run into the high visual problem again. Any ability to high gain kind of came along. Always great, thank you much for putting the garage in that sort of thing right now. A couple hocks that need to be replaced. I offered it to the maybe at some point in time I'll apply it.
That's very nice. By the way, I've been listening to you on the input, and you sound better on the input than you do through the repeater. As you know, the repeater makes these periodic noise bursts, and I don't know if you're going to be able to hear me on the input, but you can give it a try. I'm hearing you beautifully on the input, nice and strong. I wonder how many watts you're running. Now, one of the things that was mentioned tonight in the TechNet about the Mosley CM33 is you have to make sure that those black end caps at the end of the element is there, because that's one of the ways the bugs crawl in. And other people have said you've got to put a very fine piece of screening over the weep hole on the trap itself to keep the bugs from getting in. So bugs getting in is one factor, and aluminum oxide at the end of the coil is another factor. And these are critical conditions. Over to you, Charlie, the B2HMM, K2RIW.
B2OIY.
IY registration. Looking at the old 1 meter here right now, it says I'm running about 14 watts right now. To a, five-eighths wave ground plane through up at about 50 feet. YYY, please pick it up. That's the whole goal.
Calls W2OIY. Name's Joe. Dick, that guy that had the problem with the low band antenna, the beam, I think he says the TA-33, was he able to receive and just not transmit, or did he have four receive as well as four transmit?
Okay, that's his call letters were WA2PJ and Papa Juliet Foxtrot, good old Vito, and WA2RYY. You sound real good on the input. I'm hearing you on the input also. Better than through the repeater, which is making all of these flashing noises, if you know what I mean. It sounds like it arcs over every 20 seconds, 10 seconds. He never gave us a hint about receiving. His only complaint was that it suddenly, after 20 years, jumped up to a 12-to-1 standing wave ratio on transmit. He didn't say it. I know for a fact that a receiver on HF frequency usually so darn forgiving. A receiver on HF frequencies is usually so darn forgiving. Theory at 12-to-1 Vislon is going to give you, let me pick a number, 66 decibels of extra insertion loss on receive. But since the noise on the band is 20 dB above KGB, so to speak, the only real effect you're going to see is less reflection on the input meter when you're receiving. The signal-to-noise ratio could be the same. An interesting experiment while doing HF reception, if you had a step attenuator, is plug in 5, 10, 15, and 20 dB while receiving on HF. On as many times of the day when the noise is as high as it usually is, you discover that the S meter comes down, but the signal noise ratio for a long period of time of quite sounds the same. W2RIY, K2RIW.
I do know what the antenna pops. It sounds like he's got water in some antenna or some place like a trap or something like that, because to have that kind of fire like the fire, that sounds to me like what's going on. He had an open circuit someplace, he wouldn't be extremely warm. If he had like a short, because of water, it would probably give him that kind of indication where he'd be able to receive somewhat, but it has been very, very loudly.
Charlie, are you fairly sure you've got a good healthy set of end caps on the end of that driven element on your CA-33? If those end caps could fall off, then the boats have a way of crawling around the element and getting in there. So did you worry about those end caps, Charlie? The P2HMM, K2RIW.
Moisture will let you receive, but boy, it'll kill your transmission real quick.
It's kind of funny that the guy would be using this thing, and all of a sudden, one day it works, it seems like almost like he's saying, like, one day it works, and the next day, well, it doesn't work. I often wonder if the guy actually decided to check the thing up and down the band, or if he has the apparatus to check it actually out of band to find out if it moved, like, 1, 2, 3 megs out of resonance because of the severe detuning of the traps. You know, he might have just checked it on his favorite frequency. He says, uh-oh, it's 12 to 1, so it'll be broken. But, you know, maybe he didn't take, like, a scientific look at the whole approach. Yeah, antennas can be a real shame to work on sometimes, but some of the problems you can come up with, it could be, you know, insects getting there, making a nest inside, like spiders or things like that, causing some sort of unwanted water conductivity and so forth. But next week I'll bring up a good question. You actually touched upon it a little bit, this TechNet. And that was the part when you said you had to cut off some end connectors that were welded to some device they were attached to. That's exactly what my problem is, and it concerns an antenna, but not the connector of the antenna. It's taking the whole antenna apart within itself, which is similar to another antenna you described, one of the other guys described, one of the jab antennas, that has a sleeve that goes over the connector to protect the connector and to help make it more weather-resistant. I had that on a commercial antenna, and that sleeve is, in a sense, welded, or it's in a position where I can't move that sleeve or the rest of the body of the antenna, and I'm not going to cut it off, because if I cut it off, I'll ruin it, and I don't want to do that. But some genius out there on TechNet, listening to the TechNet from wherever, might have a good idea that might work. Trying to talk in the repeater now. Some imbecile out there keeps on keying up on top of Dick, and that's not helping things. I'm having a conversation with him, actually. Well, K2RWWH4YY, I'm playing with an aluminum type of antenna. The bottom end is aluminum. And I've heard bad stories about leaving aluminum out in a salt water or, salt type of atmosphere. Or so, anything, I guess, we used on the South Shore of the island are exposed to that for like a number of years can actually make this stuff like almost weld itself together. I'm sure somebody may have a way of me getting this thing apart because I definitely don't want to cut the thing apart if I can help it. I need to take the pigtail off just to make sure that the pigtail itself is probably the problem with the antenna because it doesn't resonate correctly. You know, it's the antenna itself and then all this is just, you know, wasted most amount of time. I'm doing it for nothing, but I'll have to find out when I can get the actual pigtail off to make sure that's not part of the problem, because you can't measure it by continuity of the antenna to DC ground internally, and it shows high reflective power in the amateur band, but the antenna is made from 440 to 450. It's a PD501, which is like a short, one of those short 6-foot fiberglass antennas. It's a nice antenna. I'd like to be able to use it in my house if I can, because I can't use my 11 footer anymore.
There is a I can buy allows you to clean it and make it look pretty. So if you can get that chemistry into the threads, there's a slim chance you can free it up and wait long enough for it to soak in. WA2RYY, K2RAW.
And Y2H.
An error has occurred.
Which appears to be like an end connector. It's almost like plated silverized type of metal. It's not aluminum. It looks like a good quality female end connector. That's sort of how it described the bottom end of the antenna. And it has this aluminum sleeve that goes over that, over the bottom of the antenna to protect that junction. And this sleeve is about maybe 4 inches, 5 inches long totally. And there's threads on the bottom base end of the antenna. And the inside of the sleeve has threads on it, of course, that match. You screw it together. It normally has a set screw in it, but the set screw is not there. It's missing. And maybe it fell out. I don't even care. But I physically can't get the sleeve off the bottom of the antenna. That's the problem I want to work on. Because I don't even know if I can get it. Once I get it off, I'm sure I can get the cable off the bottom of the antenna. That's not the problem. But you can't get that off with the sleeve on because it's about 3 inches up. You'll never get a pair of pliers and they'll be able to put the connector back on again.
An error has occurred.
NY2H, T2RIW recognized. One quick comment for you, Joe, and that is you could make a kind of a tool that will slip up there, tighten itself on the type end nut, and turn it, even though it's a very difficult. Yes, it's not an ordinary wrench. Over to you, Lou, NY2H, K2RIW.
I turned it on because we only had one side of the conversation, so I might as well just turn it on. I think it's on now.
Yes, it is, you, Lou. I thank you. And sounds to me like you've been given all the passcodes tonight by Eric. Go ahead, Lou.
Nah, he's still got one of them locked down. But that's all right. Alrighty, you guys carry on. And, Hal, you can jump in there too now. Alright, 73, NY2H.
Thank you, Lou. So, you and I could devise a tool that even the presence of that sleeve, you could reach up there, tighten yourself onto that connector, and turn it, Joe. I didn't say it's easy, but that's one possible approach. Over to you, Joe.
Well, I'm going to counter that by saying that would be very, very impossible to do because the antenna connector itself and cable is covered with the weatherproofing I described, which is made by Decibel Products, that weather wrap, vapor wrap stuff made by Decibel Products, which is what I recommend you use for some of your outdoor applications. Very good stuff to use, very pliable, and it lasts for a long, long time.
Okay. So it looks like you've got to remove that sleeve. And I guess it's right now aluminum welded. And so I'd like to believe somebody's got chemistry that'll dissolve aluminum oxide and free that up. We just got to find the person that knows the right stuff. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, it's like you say every week. There's a lot of brain power out here in the metro area and with all the other connections of people listening from around the country and so forth. Somebody probably has, they'd be able to put their two cents in and come up with a solution that'll probably solve the problem for me economically without me causing, having to destroy a $400 or $500 antenna.
Out of curiosity, do you know of a person who would like to send to Mars? Who's your joke?
Oh, apparently there's a lot of people, as I've heard, that are all lined up. They can't wait to go. And it's like these people aren't thinking about the whole process. It's a one-way trip, and you're going to die up there. And you may not even make it to Mars to begin with. Because this is going to be like a first-time mission, sending a human being that far in space. You have no idea what's going to happen. And once you get out of the protection of the Van Allen belts and everything else that keeps the site and comfy cozy down here, how do you know how long a human being can be able to survive in that kind of environment way, way out there in space, you don't know. You don't know what's going to do to you for a year's worth of time.
Yep. There's a hell of a lot more unknowns than known in that project. They've got a long way to go. And long way to go, boy, roughly 330 million miles, roughly a year or a year and a half of time, living for that time in a sardine can on the way there, finding some way to get a house full of oxygen, water, and food into that sardine can. Oh, guarantee you, it's an extreme case of what happens to my buddies who got onto a sailboat and sailed themselves from Long Island to Bermuda. And my favorite buddy, one or two of those nights, was on the night shift, steering the boat in pitch blackness of the sea, fairly large rolling sea, so he can see nothing but hundreds and hundreds of miles of seawater in all directions. Everyone else on the boat is sleeping. He's at the helm. He knows if he does a goof and he falls overboard, nobody would know about it, and it would be game over. And he sits there and says, "What the hell have I done to put myself in this position at this time, and why the hell do I want to be here?" How was your joke? T2RIW.
You know something? That's a very good analogy. That's exactly what you'd be doing. It's like taking a small sailboat to Bermuda. After a short amount of time, you're out in the middle of nowhere with absolutely nothing around you to help you or save you if you get into something. I don't know. I don't know who would want to volunteer. I wouldn't want to volunteer for something like that. It's not a one-way trip. It may not even be a one-way trip. It may be half a one-way trip. You have no idea what's going to happen to you. And this is something I've often wondered. Once you get out of the gravitational pull of the Earth, the Sun, within reason, what stops your craft from keeping it getting hit by micrometeoroids, the things that are traveling at 18 miles a second or with some ridiculously high volume velocity out there that can go right clean through your spacecraft, and you. It's a lot of risk. So you think about the whole thing, but the whole picture, you got a lot of risk you're taking by, you know, I mean, someday it's going to have to be done, but, you know, I just don't think we have the technology in the next 10 years to be able to do it comfortably.
That's an understatement, Joe. Definitely an understatement. 100 years, maybe. 10 years, not a chance. Way too many details here. These guys are dreaming they can do it for $6 billion when it's 100 to 1,000 times more difficult than going to the moon. And the Apollo program took $31 billion to go to the moon. So, not likely. Yes, some things do get cheaper because you've got better later technology. I don't think that much. Still, the big bucks are in the booster power, and you're going to need that booster no matter what to just get off the Earth with all your hardware and people and habitats and everything else and food and air and water and oxygen and living out of a spacesuit. And Mars has temperatures that are like minus 150 degrees. I mean, that rolls off the tongue easily. If you've ever been in minus 40 degree temperature, and you dream about what minus 150 would be like. Wow. Way beyond life-threatening. Way beyond. And if you're in that environment, and if there isn't the world's best insulation between the core of your body and that environment, and we're talking about 98 degrees positive versus 150 degrees negative, we're talking about 240 degrees of delta. And across that 240 degrees of delta, which is the insulation between your core and that environment. Let me drop. The rate at which you're losing heat is huge. So if you're not consuming some very large number of calories, which drastically accelerates the amount of food and air and oxygen you need, in order to generate enough heat to keep your core at roughly 98 Fahrenheit, it's game over. I mean, I did a slim study one time of what happens if you got this great big sledge, a great big sleigh-like thing, and you're walking across Antarctica because you want to claim the first person that walked on his feet to the North Pole or the South Pole. Let's make it the South Pole. And if you run out of fuel by the fuel by which you cook your food, and you say, that's not a problem. I've got a bunch of dry food. And where's the water going to come from? The food doesn't do any good without water. Well, I got a whole lot of snow around me. I'll just scoop up some of the snow and put it in my mouth. Well, hold on now. Your body has to make an investment to take that snow at minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit. You first warm it up to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. You make an investment to do that, from minus 40 to plus 32. And then you've got the 80 calories per gram in order to convert it from ice into liquid. Then you warm it from 32 up to 98. Until that water is at 98 degrees and it's inside of your body, it ain't doing you any good. So just by scooping up that snow and saying, I'm going to have enough water to drink, you better have a lot of extra calories to run that body that's doing that, because you've got to make a big investment, thermodynamic investment, just to take that damn snow and ice and convert it into potable water inside your body so you can continue to carry on metabolism. Do you see what's going on here, Joe? Life ain't simple. W-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-A-W.
Let me jump in one more time. I just want to remind you that at 1 o'clock, you know, the ROV link drops. It comes back in a few minutes, but that's automatic. It's going to happen in a few minutes, just so you know.
Thank you, Lou. We'll survive that. You got it, Joe.
Something, Dick, something you mentioned earlier, and this is something I just never heard this before, about the guy being out in space in his spacesuit working for a considerable length of time, and he almost got, like, frostbite to his fingers. I thought these suits were insulated to the point where it would keep the guy fairly comfortable for a long amount of time. I didn't realize, you know, that. I know what you're talking about. You're talking about temperatures that could be something like, what, 200 degrees below zero on one side of the suit, the dark side of the suit, so to speak, compared to what your human body, you know, temperature is. But I thought these suits, after so many years of NASA putting these together, had that science, you know, kind of figured out pretty good, but I guess not.
The man was Tori Musgrove. He's doing the first major repair mission on the Hubble Space Telescope. The suit itself, every bit of the suit is extremely well insulated, except the gloves. A human being has got all kinds of capability in space, if and only if he has full maneuvering capability of that very complicated thing called a human hand. So that glove is not well insulated. It's got enough layers of thickness to keep the air pressure in there so your hand is not boiling as far as the moisture, you know, boiling away because of lack of pressure. So the glove is pressurized, but it is not well insulated. And so he was right at the threshold of frostbite on his fingers throughout a tremendous number of hours of that mission. For the rest of his life, he has no feeling in all of the fingers of both hands. He made that dedication. He had a good guess that that was possibly going to happen, and it did. Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
Well, he knew the whole picture. The whole picture was he's out there, he's it, and he took the chance that if I stay out here long enough, this might happen to me. But that's a commitment the guy made. But that's unfortunate to hear something like that. But I never heard of that before, that this happened to a U.S. astronaut. I never really gave it much thought, but it makes a lot of sense. If the gloves have to be flexible enough so the human hand can move around and do things it has to do, maybe you sacrifice a little bit of thermal insulation, or what would be the right word? You know what I want to say. You're sacrificing some of the thermalness of the effectiveness of the glove for flexibility and having the way it can be moved around, because I guess the rest of the suit is so rich and so thick that the arms and legs don't move too much except in the joints, that you can put more padding in there, make it more thermally comfortable.
You got it, Joe. And maybe in the next minute I'm going to be cut off for a few minutes, but you and I can still hear each other on 375, but yes, he made a huge dedication, Joe, the Story Musgrove, astronaut, black astronaut, by the way. I think he's the first black astronaut, and his history of his family is out of sight. His father had committed suicide, his grandfather had committed suicide, his brother had committed suicide, tremendous number of suicides in the family, and he's the high achiever of the family, and he knew that exposure at the upper edge of the Van Allen belt, at the altitude of the Hubble flies, he knew that he was going to get a lifetime exposure of radiation damage. He knew he's going to be using the suit to the absolute maximum. It's good for roughly 8 hours, 7.5 hours, with a safety backup margin, extra oxygen tank. He went to something like 8.5 hours. He knew he had to get back into the airlock. While he's getting back into the airlock, the auxiliary standby extra tank also ran out. He was completely out of air. While he's in the airlock, he grabs the emergency hose that's in that airlock and plugs it into the suit just before he goes unconscious. He really pushed it. And when you listen to a face-to-face discussion of the details of what he did on that mission, you say, man, that guy is dedicated. Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system.
I thought the guy was a white guy, actually, and I'm not African American. I thought he was a white guy, rather elderly, actually. But maybe you're right.
Story Musgrove is an African American. Somewhat light skinned, but he is an African American. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, yeah. All in all, the guy made a huge dedication to get the job done. He was committed to get the job done because he knew coming back would just eat up a lot of time and so forth, and it had to be done. Since I guess NASA probably learned a very good lesson on something like that. Have they done anything with the spacesuits to be able to maybe help insulate the hand areas a little better?
26 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
I think the answer is no. I think they've made no change to the glove of the spacesuit. And he had a strong inkling that the Hubble Space Telescope was going to be an extremely significant piece of hardware, and he was willing to make that lifetime dedication. Arguably the most highly productive piece of hardware NASA has ever created, with the help of a bunch of foreign governments, by the way. It wasn't strictly a NASA design. But the Hubble Space Telescope, many people believe it's the most productive piece of hardware that NASA ever produced. He had an inkling that that was coming, and it was worth the dedication of you, Joe, KGRIW.
I think that goes without saying, because that thing has allowed mankind, who's running it, to be able to detect and see much, much further than we've ever could have even imagined, like 35, 40 years ago, that this thing could see that far out into space, in the vastness of space, and give you the clarity and the depth of what you're looking at to be able to examine stuff that you could never even possibly imagine before. I guess the next one goes up, what's up, James something? I guess we'll talk about that eventually when that starts getting underway. That's going to basically put the Hubble to shame?
Yes and no. They complement each other. The James Webb Space Telescope, roughly 2018, I think it's got 10 times more area of its mirror. That gives it a lot more sensitivity and range, and it's an infrared telescope. As such, it can look through a hell of a lot of the dust that's around the star nurseries. I mean, a nursery for stars has got a lot of dust where you can't look in there and really see what's happening. But James Webb, you're going to see that. It's an ambitious mission. I mean, this huge mirror, 10 times the area of the Hubble mirror, all gets folded up into 16 individual pieces into the spacecraft. And that spacecraft is going to launch it 1 million miles away from Earth, on the backside of the Earth, away from the Sun. Away from the Sun and Moon, at the Lagrange point number 2. So no way in hell is anybody ever going to go there to repair it. It's got to be perfect on the first shot all by itself. Hubble would have not been able to do 1% of what it has done if it wasn't for that whole series of repair missions where they kept updating it with better and better detectors, better and better inertial wheels, better and better power supplies, better and better solar cells, and so on. Tremendous improvement. And people have made jokes about, well, we'll bring it home and repair it and send it back up. Out of the question. Let me drop. We don't have that capability. And when it comes to the Hubble Deep Field, the Hubble Extreme Deep Field, and the Hubble Ultra Deep Field pictures, they looked at a chunk of sky. You're about to say, how big is the angle? It's the amount of sky you would see by looking down the center of a straw. So you look down the center of the straw. You aim Hubble into some dark area of space where you think there is nothing, but you got a suspicion there might be something there. And you integrate that picture for 1 million seconds. I think it's roughly a week. So you've got a week of observing, and you've got your photocells, your focal plane array of very sensitive detectors, integrating every single photon they can find for 1 million seconds. And you look at that picture, and it's got 2,600 galaxies you never even knew existed, that you never saw before. Can you imagine? I mean, that's the amount of angle and azimuth and elevation that you can see when looking through a straw. Imagine if you looked in all directions in sequence, you looked at all directions in space, there were probably 10,000 pictures. Can you imagine what you would find? On top of that, Hubble, the other thing Hubble did, let me drop this. By using the Hubble to make these measurements of the Cepheid variables and the 1A, E1, I think they're called, the supernovas, you now found out how fast is all the stuff that's splitting away, how fast is it slowing down, how long will it be before the Big Bang becomes the Big Crunch. And all of a sudden they find out that all the stuff out at the perimeter is not slowing down, it's speeding up. And there were two separate groups and two separate techniques of measurement, independent of each other. The first group got that result and said, well, something's wrong. We'll wait and see what the other group has. And the other group discovered the exact same thing. He said, holy blank, what the hell's going on here? I've got the vaguest idea what it is. You give it a name, dark energy. How in the world can you get something where As you spread further and further away, the force of repulsion gets stronger and stronger. And it's a repulsive force. There's a double craziness there. Hubble discovered that. Over to you, Joe, KQLAW.
That'll be amazing what this new telescope, the James Webb thing, will discover. It probably thinks of, you only imagine what you saw before. My local ID going off the background. But, you're talking about something that's basically what? Mid-80s technology from Hubble? Something like that?
Yes and no. When it was first launched, yes. But the updates it's been given, when it comes to the detectors, the wide field planetary camera, the WFPT camera, I think you could say that's 2005 technology. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so you got a couple of good, needed updates to help along. I can understand what this other thing being a million miles out, especially, that far out. If something goes wrong, that's it. And what is this thing going to cost, by the way? $10-15 billion?
It's spread out over a 10-year or 15-year development and construction, but yes. Total price is, I forgot. I might be wrong, but my memory says $8 billion. And now, you and I can figure out that $8 billion, what is it for every man, woman, and child in the United States? It's approximately the price of a Starbucks coffee. And now, is that a Starbucks coffee every day, or is it twice a week? I'm not sure. But no doubt in my mind, we're getting our money's worth. Over to you, Joe.
Oh, I wouldn't even think of it like that, because even if you're 10 times that amount per person, the knowledge you're going to gain from this one way or another has got to be helpful to mankind in general. It's got to help you one way or the other. We can't keep on sitting on this planet, just being here, because what latest figure that I heard, something like by 2050, this planet's going to have 9 billion people on it. You won't be around. I won't be around. But it'll be pretty crowded for 9 billion people, don't you think?
Yeah, we've got roughly 7 billion now. The total NASA budget of all of these Spirit and Opportunity and Curiosity and all of these launches of all these spacecraft and the development of the James Webb Space Telescope and whatever, the total NASA budget is $57 a year for every man, woman, and child. The $57 a year, I guess that turns out to be, yes, that's one Starbucks coffee every week. Over to you, Joe.
$57 per person. And what did it cost to launch the, I forget the exact name of the one that's like three times the distance of Pluto out? What did that whole shebang cost to launch in its day?
Yeah, that's the Voyager. The Voyager? Yeah, I think it's Voyager. It's three times the distance to Pluto. Launched in 1977. Something like 37 years ago. I don't know the number, but if I had to guess, I'll bet you it's in the vicinity of less than $2 billion of that day. Yeah, go ahead. The Hubble Space Telescope, and it was brand new, I think was $2 billion. Over to you, Joe.
Well, it seems like the government or no one else can't get involved. They don't build anything with M on the end of it. Everything has a B on the end of it now. There's nothing that costs millions of dollars. Now it's B with a billion. Now you're talking real money.
Could say that each B-2 airplane was $2 billion. I forget the number of those they built. Each B-1 airplane was $250 million, and they built 100 of those. So the total B-1B bomber program, which I worked on for 20 years, I think that total investment was in the vicinity of $32 billion. Go ahead.
Well, they do what they have to do. They get their money's worth out of these projects. But, when you start adding up, like an aircraft costing $2 billion, these subs cost far more than that. Same thing with the aircraft carriers. Now you're talking about some real serious money. They don't build too many of them. So, that'd be, pretty careful how you put your stuff together and keeping it, keeping it running for a long time. So you get into these different space missions, putting all these different things together. Yeah, collectively, it is a lot of money, a lot of time and effort involved collectively to make this thing work. And I guess we'll just say this Mars thing is going to be something like, you know, several billion dollars to put this whole thing together and get it actually, you know, stepping forward.
This Danish company, correction, this Dutch company that's doing this Mars mission with volunteers thinks that they can get it rolling for $6 billion. And I'm convinced that number is way too low. They think they're going to launch in the year 2024. I know that's way too soon. And the goal is much too high, much too difficult. The chance of survival is much too low. The fact that you've got volunteers tells me that our youth is very enthusiastic about space and science. And it gives them a lot of vision and purpose and so on. I go for that. But this particular goal, I guess there's a philosophy saying that the worst guy in the world is the guy who has achieved all his goals. That it's the seeking that's the real fun. Once you get there, it becomes old hat, and you say to yourself, well, what am I going to do now? Cody Joe, KTRIW.
Okay, Tilly J. By the way, the cost of Voyager 1 in its day with its dollars was only $250 million, including the lunch.
Hey, Eric, I have news for you.
Boy, is that cheap. You got it, Luke?
Yeah, Eric, you know, the link is down right now because it resets. And as these guys are talking, I can hear the Seldon keying up. So it's the link receiver. Can you shut the link receiver off remotely?
No, that's what I was trying to do earlier today. I didn't get a chance to because it took so damn long for the thing to shut down. When I get home, I'll give it a shot. But, yeah, that's what I picked up were going on. So, you know. Yeah, I can't. Hey, if the Selvin side is reachable, yeah, when I get home, I'm driving and just coming back from the desert.
Yeah, I understand. I just wanted to give you an update and let you know. If you can't get in tonight for some reason, shoot me an email or something, you know. Go by there tomorrow and I'll shut the thing off.
Are you talking about the Windows machine in Selvin?
No, I'm talking about the Master 2.
No, I can turn it off if I can get to the Windows machine at Selvin.
Yeah, you should be able to get to it.
All right, well, about a half hour, I'll be home. I just got out of the tunnel.
All right, NY2H.
Okay, KU2J.
Eric, there's a subject I've wanted to discuss with you for a while. You know, I could be very naive, I'll warn you. But my question is, the voting system we're now using, is there a way to slow it down? I have the impression that every, I'm going to pick a number, 10 milliseconds, it makes a judgment that the channel delta versus channel echo, echo has got a little bit stronger signal, so we'll switch over the channel echo as a remote receiver. But it makes those switches so darn fast that if a person is walking through, if he's driving through an area where he would normally get picket fencing, I have the impression that when it switches from one remote receiver to another, that there's a fairly long delay time. It acts like there is a break before make, but there's a very long dead time. And so the switching rapidly and the long dead time, as if there was a great big spike that's generated that takes a while for the audio to recover. I wish there was a way of slowing down the switching. In other words, could it integrate the answer for 5 seconds and say, okay, with that picket fencing of 5 seconds, it looks like the average of delta is better than echo. Let's switch over to delta and stay there for a while. I'm probably, as I said, very naive. KE2EJ, KTRIW.
KE2EJ, you know, naive. The thing's broken. It's actually supposed to go out and hold. Not supposed to switch away. I changed that 6 months ago or 9 months ago. But it seems not to be working at the moment. Plus, there's another issue that we just spoke about with Lou, which is adding to the problem, which making you think that, making you think that something like that is happening. So, I was up there today, but I had to be somewhere else, and the Windows machine there hasn't been updated in years or months. It took about an hour, almost an hour of change to
didn't wait for it to shut down, you wouldn't have a repeater tonight, so, you know, that's the story. It'll get resolved. You know, I'm finally getting some time to do some of this stuff again, so. Bit by bit. K2RIW, KA2J.
Dick, may I say something about what you just asked?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I worked on GE voting systems. Not that particular one, because that's a little more advanced, but I worked on earlier versions, and I can tell you how they react. The voter looks at all possibilities, meaning a yellow or unsquelched card in Iraq. It could be 3 out of 6, 4 out of 6, 2 out of 6. And then it tries to look at the best signal-to-noise ratio within reason of all the cards that it has. Two things will drive it crazy. Audio inequality between channels, in other words, having different audio levels coming in will drive it crazy. And number two, having different frequency responses coming in per channel, that will also drive it crazy. I've noticed that sometimes when people are like heavy on the microphone and really beeping pretty high, the thing wants to jump to other receivers. And I think that might be partially, you might be closing the receiver's squelch on the channel they're on, and it goes just simply elsewhere for a split second, then goes back to where it came from.
That's very true. In this case, actually, we're using the tone squelch as, you know, we're not using noise squelch. We're only allowing the voter to make a determination as far as signal noise of the incoming signal after the tone decoder has been turned on. And there's some smarts about it, about making a decision, and then there's a timer circuit that says, okay, hang on to this, and that point's not working.
Sounds like it's running the continuous voting.
Yeah, right now it's back to what you would call continuous voting, yes.
If it wasn't continuous voting, how long does it would it be able to integrate its answer? My gut feels that if it could look for, let's say, 5 seconds and say, all right, over that 5 second period, this one looks like the best. But if it's making instantaneous decisions, that creates a hell of a lot more switching than you would like. Is that roughly what's going on, Eric?
No, it makes the decision very quickly. It's not a matter of seconds. There is a delay once it makes the decision. When it's in a continuous voting mode, which is, I think, something like 250 or 400 milliseconds or something in that neighborhood. The voter itself is not all that sophisticated, you know. It's basically a bridge of making a decision and creating a voltage level from the amount of quieting, if you want to call it that. You know, it's got an impulse detector in it. It rectifies, it creates a voltage, charges a capacitor, and you get the idea.
If it was working just right, and if it made a correct decision to switch from remote receiver number 3 to remote receiver number 4, during that transition, how much audio dropout would take place? Eric, go ahead.
Well, if it's tuned up right, and everything is balanced properly, and the levels are correct, your ear should not be able to hear it. It's milliseconds.
I think you're telling me that a fraction of a cycle of my voice, where my voice was instantaneously putting out a positive voltage, it might be a slight phase difference, and it would pick up a negative voltage at that instant. Except for that click, I think you're saying I would almost not know anything's happening. Is that true?
Everything's done right, yeah, you won't notice it. When things start going wrong, you notice it very quickly. There's another factor here, is that we were down a voting receiver. I had just repaired that, and actually I had John put it back up. The power amplifier that was associated with that got very fried, so what I did was I modified the amplifier and got rid of the back end of it, which is a pair of transistors, and I'm just running it on the driver. I've got it set for about 18 watts, so the amount of natural noise that the remote receiver is picking up, it's a different, and it hasn't been balanced yet, so that's adding to the thing, and I'll be back in a second.
Dick, that voter, if it's what I believe it is, that's about 20 years old in its technology. And the stuff I worked on was about 18 years previous to that as far as its technology.
I can tell you this. With the older cell, which doesn't have any ICs, this particular one, I think, has a lot of ICs on it for card. I worked for one two-way shop many years ago, and I had to fix that type of odor, you know, the earlier version of this, but they work pretty much the same, very similar. And to be able to test the cards, I had to wire up a rack and feed audio to all six channels at once, simultaneously, and I use an audio source of a receiver receiving the weather radio from New York. So that was my audio source that gave me, you know, modulation and so forth. And fed that to all six cards. I'm feeding the same audio from one source to all six cards simultaneously through resistive networks to isolate each card a little bit. The cards still would not just lock up on one card. With the same exact audio voltage going to each card, it would still jump from cards 2, 3, 4, maybe 4 out of 6 cards. So there are intricacies within each card itself that makes it slightly imperfect. And these voters are capable of voting down to about 1 or 2 decibels difference between one channel to another, and they can look at stuff down to about a 40 dB noise level, if even more than that, and still see if they see a difference between one to the other of 1 or 2 decibels, they'll jump from one card to another. So that's why having audio fidelity, audio levels balancing is extremely important in one of these systems.
Yeah, I sense there's a lot of art and science to voting, and to get it all running right ain't easy. It sounds like there's only about 15 ways that it can not quite run right. Is that roughly a joke?
You know, there's a couple of different methods. I mean, we're using the GE method, where the duck hole voter is a bit different.
I presume you
had a voting system set up on my repeater, a repeater system on not the frequencies operating now, set up about 20-something years ago using a voting system. From my one time, I had 5 different sites on it, receiving sites in the air, and I did everything through radio links, and I got it to sound pretty much like a wireline circuit.
I presume you...
No, I don't know that, and actually everything that we're doing is radio links, so it adds some more variables. And you had 5 or 6 receivers going, you spent a bit of time tweaking it.
I also spend a lot of time building it, too.
Yeah, well, same difference. I mean, I have the hardware from, from GE, so, I didn't have to build it, I didn't have to make it work.
Joe, when you took that weather receiver and you put it into all 6 channels with the resistor divider network, and it was switching around 4 of those channels, as it did all that switching, did the resultant audio coming out sound relatively clean?
Yes. I can tell you this, from working on commercial systems just recently, and these are circuits where they're using, like, you know, telco lines and or microwave links. So you basically signal to noise ratio on your link channels per channel is way down there, maybe like, you know, 50 decibels or something like that, extremely low. So that takes that out of the picture. If you align all your equipment from start to finish on every single channel and make it as like a mirror image from one to another to another to another, at the end of the day, when you listen to it and some user comes on the system, you can stand by the comparator, listen to the output of the repeater, and watch the thing go from channel to channel to channel, and your ear cannot tell what it did.
Yeah, that's a good sign. I presume right now, because of enough links are not possible, that the voting is done by a high-frequency squelch circuit, is my guess, Eric. In other words, you're looking for the hiss noise above the audio to make a decision as to how strong is the signal-to-noise ratio, and therefore how to do the voting. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Now, these voters are capable of doing a couple things. First of all, these voters will use what they call a voting tone, if you choose to use it, and that actually is the reference for determining what the best signal noise is. If you're not using that kind of setup, then you're subject to whatever the link signal noise is. That's what you're starting with. Then, from the link signal noise, perhaps the actual remote receiver signal noise is getting to speak to. But when we set it up and it's working right, you're basically trying to feed the same signal into all the receivers and have the levels balanced first off, and then to try to make it so that the links themselves equal by putting that same signal in each remote location and then balancing it out that way, and then doing the best you can with the individual receivers input. So it's a process.
The voting tone that you mentioned, Eric, is that a low frequency tone or a high frequency tone?
They're all subaudible. Now it depends on the manufacturer. I think I've seen one that's up at the high end. But yeah, that's a whole different thing. They're in the subaudible range. They're still different.
So the subaudible voting tone, you measure either that tone amplitude, I sort of doubt that. I'm guessing you're measuring signal to noise ratio of that tone. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, let
me say something here. There's a tone that's called a status tone. That's sent to the card when the card is not receiving something from the remote end. That keeps the squelch, the card closed. That tone typically is 1970 hertz. You normally don't hear that rebroadcast through the system because it's got at least a 50 dB filter in the audio path from any of those receivers and those cards to the transmitter. So you normally never hear. You hear the harmonics of it, but you don't hear that tone itself.
In the case of a subaudio tone, are you literally doing a SINAD measurement on that subaudio tone in order to do voting, Eric? Go ahead.
You know what? It's been a while since I've even had to think about this. I would refrain from answering it without taking a look at the schematic again to give you the exact answer as to what this particular system is doing.
Okay. Do we have the ability of using a voting tone of, say, 2KC as opposed to subaudio if we wanted to?
No, now that I'm thinking about it, this uses the 2KC, I think it's 2126 or something like that. Some wacko frequency. But it is not subaudible. It's the high frequency tone.
Yeah, I see an advantage of the high frequency tone because as the carrier gets weaker, the output of a discriminator will put out high-frequency hiss a lot faster than low-frequency hiss. So therefore, you get a lot more preemptive knowledge that signal is becoming weak. Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe that's correct. And actually, now that I'm thinking about it, in the master suite itself, you can select from two different high frequencies, and you can also select a subaudible, depending upon which decoder card you have.
So in other words, the voting receiver is looking for that tone, but you've got a notch filter sucking that tone back out before the audio really gets repeated through the repeater. Is that true?
Yeah, I believe that's correct. I know in the Master 3 they used a DSP for it, and in the Master 2 I think it's an actual active op amp situation.
You had an exciting time in New Jersey today, working on high power electronics.
What do you mean, this evening?
Roger, you're coming back from New Jersey. I'm guessing you're working on somebody's transmitter out there.
Well, not tonight. Actually, I'm going to be rebuilding the whole transmitter facility, including knocking the building down, putting up a new building. Now, tonight we were... The station is a... listener-supported station. So for the past 3 weeks, we've been running what we call a pledge marathon. And basically, tonight, we finally raised $1 million, which will run the station for the next year. And we did that, producing video, streaming video. But I just finished building a studio facility in there, both video and audio. So, I'm participating.
Fantastic. Would this be associated with Channel 50, which I quite often watch?
No. Channel 50 is NJTV, which is really WNEZ, which is the same as WLIW. No, this is a what we call a freeform radio station. It's WFMU. If you want to see what it looks like, go to WFMU.org.
would I know, would you be able to tell me a UHF channel number? Because it's possible I've watched it. Go ahead.
No,